Welcome to the Max Finance Podcast, where a certified financial planner and personal finance geek discuss how to make intentional financial decisions that maximize your money and achieve your goals. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Max Finance Podcast. Today, we will be chatting about, I think, a popular topic that a lot of people, a lot of folks that I speak to and a lot of friends, and you know, there's just a lot of hype in the media and so forth. It has its ups and downs when we're talking about crypto. In terms of setting up the scene, kind of what is it, broadly speaking? How can you invest or purchase? And maybe what are some things? I think maybe spending more of the time really talking about, if you've already know roughly what it is and how much you want to own it, how much should you own, and how does that make up perhaps in the broader context of your portfolio? So, a little rough framing there, but Lauren, anything else that you would want to add, I guess, in terms of the rough outline and agenda here for our conversation today?
I think maybe just hopefully we can provide some maybe practical advice, for folks who want to own cryptocurrency and how that can be, you know, part of their investment portfolio and do it in a way that is, I guess, responsible, I guess I should say. I don't know if that's the right word, but is reasonable, I'd say, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, appropriate for their situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that makes sense to spend perhaps more of the time on there, but you know, because there's all sorts of podcasts out there, or you know, specialized websites or whatever to go and track and get more up to speed on all of the ins and outs of this. But maybe at a high level, what are we talking about here? What is crypto?
Yeah, so I'm going to read a definition that I found, and then I'll kind of unpack it a little bit, but. Cryptocurrency is a digital currency in which transactions are verified and records maintained by a decentralized system using cryptography rather than a centralized authority. So basically what it means is the store of value, what we call like a ledger, which basically records who has how much money, is maintained by a decentralized system, meaning there's not a single kind of entity or corporation or company that maintains that. It is maintained by multiple computers sort of all over the world, and really anyone can kind of contribute and be a, call it node, I think is what it's called, and store that information. So essentially the ownership of how much each person owns is stored in a system where everybody stores it and everybody has access to view it as well. And cryptography is a method of essentially, I think, basically encrypting things, kind of like how passwords are stored, how we secure files or systems in a way where it's, you know, mostly more or less secure. And I think the last part is important, that it's not really run by a centralized authority, which, so it's not like a we call it a fiat currency like the US dollar, which is, you know, operated by, I guess I should know this ahead of time, the Federal Reserve, maybe, or the U.S. Mint or something like that, or basically the U.S. government,
yeah,
some department of the U.S. government, yeah. Where they can control the you know, things like they can do things to kind of change the interest rate, as well as kind of the money in the market, whereas there's not really a single entity that can control those things. A lot of these things are kind of preset, and then changes to the system, if they want to be made, they kind of have to be voted upon, essentially by the people who run those kind of the nodes. So anyway, it's started, I think, in 2000. Well, I was looking, Bitcoin is really the first cryptocurrency that was sort of introduced in a white paper in 2008. And since then, there have been many cryptocurrencies that have kind of spawned, but Bitcoin's definitely the biggest and most popular one.
Yeah, and I guess just for all listeners out there, I first disclosure from my perspective is I am not an expert in the space. I definitely have interacted with about this subject with clients and can speak maybe on how to think about it from an overall portfolio standpoint. But I know there's different components in it, which is the underlying technology. The point you just brought up where it's not controlled by a central government that has it introduces bias or influence, political sway into the currency and can manipulate it and use it as a potentially as a weapon. I'm sure we've seen that, particularly in the form of sanctions or kind of cutting, most recently cutting governments off from using it or a government off from using it, the financial markets. So this is a lot. There's a lot of components there. Is there any other element beyond just the underlying technology, which is revolutionary, and the decentralization of this currency? Is there any other elements to crypto at large?
I think you touched on it, but I think the impact or the consequence of it is if you choose to own it in a way where you really have full control over, like, call the encryption keys, no one can take it away from you. I mean, they might steal your device that has it, and if you haven't made kind of proper backups of it, you know, you could lose it. But it's not like you keep your money in a bank, and if you do the wrong thing, you know, the U.S. government could seize your assets or, you know, freeze them essentially. Mm-hmm. So if you owned cryptocurrency in a certain manner, you couldn't have it seized. But again, there's kind of some nuances there. So the one is that is kind of, and as well as, you know, I think we are in, you know, we're both in the U.S. and we're fortunate to be able to participate in a very generally stable economy with a very kind of stable value of currency, right? But I think a lot of people around the world live in places where the value of the currency is not stable. And like rapid inflation can be something that can really erode purchasing power very, very quickly. And so there's a lure there that cryptocurrency could be a solution there. And I think some countries, some people have kind of used it and has provide some value there, but obviously cryptocurrency, which we'll talk about, is not always very stable as well. There are some cryptocurrencies that are meant to be pretty stable in value, but many are not and can be volatile though.
Yeah, just as you were saying that, I was thinking like, wow, yeah, you're right. There's all sorts of countries that just do not aren't necessarily looking out for their citizens' best interests, and you know, we got rampant inflation, hyperinflation, just destroying where you know need thousands or millions to buy just simple goods, so instead using Bitcoin as an example to am I misremembering this, but I think Honduras is one that they allow like Bitcoin is people could pay their taxes in Bitcoin, or
it could be Honduras. I know Venezuela has adopted it as some, like, I think as a government, they've purchased quite a lot of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I think they may allow certain things to be purchased as like, I think it's Venezuela. Not exactly sure what their use of it is, but it looks like they have kind of embraced Bitcoin.
Yes. Apparently, yeah, something around Honduras as well. But all of these governments that you know traditionally are not necessarily the most stable. So utilizing Bitcoin could be a real because I think that's at least when you ask maybe those who are really skeptical about crypto is, well, how is this really going to change the game, and can you really buy goods? Is this meant to literally replace the dollar? Is this meant to be just another an asset class, a separate asset class, or maybe you could talk a little bit about that or your thoughts.
Yeah, well, we can't really speak broadly about all cryptocurrencies.
Sure.
I think each cryptocurrency has its own sort of goals and particular use case in mind when it was developed. I think Bitcoin's the first and it's the most popular. And I would say, I believe the intention of Bitcoin and people who actively develop it and you know, use it is that it is you know, a kind of a replacement currency, or sometimes they call it like a native currency of the internet. So it is meant to be a form of currency that can be spent. Now, you know, yeah, you can actually, what is the value of using it to buy a cup of coffee over, you know, using cash or a credit card? And maybe there may not be. But again, I think there are situations where I think the ability for maybe people who, you know, for instance, you know, people who don't have like a verifiable identity, right? Or maybe they're you know, they're not able to participate in the economy. They can't open a bank account. Maybe they're, you know, maybe they're an illegal immigrant or something in a country, and they can't, you know, have financial services there because they don't have documentation, for instance. In the future, something like Bitcoin could allow them to maybe, you know, transact there. So there's a couple of different ways, and there's so many cryptocurrency projects, many have very specific sort of uses, and some of them are more like tokens that allow you to have voting power in doing these things and facilitating very specific types of interactions or solving some particular type of problem. So yeah, can't really speak to all of them broadly, but I think just generally there is a optimism there that that these types of technologies can solve a lot of problems and can be pretty valuable in the future.
What is your attraction to this space? Is this something that you've been interested in for quite some time, or had your eye on, had been somebody on the sidelines looking in, or you've had some exposure and owned some of these crypto yourself?
I have owned some. I don't really own any meaningful amount right now. I'm more just kind of curious in the technology. I think it's really fascinating how it works. I'm pretty interested in cryptography as well, like just understanding how encryption works. So it is, to me, I'm just something that piques my interest a lot.
And just for the layman or woman, layperson, what is cryptography? Do you have maybe a rough, is it just the encryption behind it? I'm sure there's like an essay that you could read off for that, but is that purely just sort of the encryption aspect of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'm trying to find a quick definition of this, but it essentially like refers to secure information or communication techniques based on mathematical formulas or algorithms. So it's a way of let me try to say this.
Like based on, you know, you've got a computer system and I, you know, it's distributed. Is that an element of the cryptography you're referring to, or
it doesn't have to do with being distributed. Uh-huh. Being distributed is a kind of a separate aspect of it, which kind of provides that level of transparency as well as agreement of like everybody knows that you have 5 Bitcoin and I have 1 Bitcoin. That it's distributed. Everyone kind of hosts that mm-hmm. like
the ledger.
Mm-hmm. Cryptography is the way in which you only have access to spend the Bitcoin that you are supposed to have, and so that I cannot spend yours. I cannot impersonate you
because I've got the password and you do not.
Right. And it's also right now, I believe, for Bitcoin, it's also cryptography is heavily used in terms of kind of what's called mining of it, essentially. So,
creating it. Yeah, that's another fascinating aspect of the currency. Now, is that unique to Bitcoin, or is this something that occurs with every, or probably depends?
I think coin. Probably many or most, right? Because there needs to be a way to introduce the coins into the market, and mining is a way where the computers that run the software that help to store this ledger, this distributed ledger, they are rewarded for doing that by mining. So if you mine by doing that, every so often you will quote unquote mine a coin. It gets harder and harder as time goes on, as there's more computing power that are all trying to do the same thing. But essentially that's how like money is distributed into the system, or not money, but the coins are distributed into the system, is through mining. And that's a cryptographic function where essentially it's what at a high level, what it allows you to do is it allows me to like show you that I have the password for something and I can prove it to you and you can understand that proof, but I don't have to give you that password for you to like understand that. That's kind of what cryptography is about, is you have like a public key and a private key, and I only have the private key, but everyone else can see that I have the private key, but they can't see what it is. Mm. And that allows me to prove ownership of my wallet of coins and to be able to spend it. But no one else can, but they can understand that and agree that I own that and I have access to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I remember there was a craze, you know, a couple of years back, where maybe not even that long ago, maybe it was, but where everybody was like, "Oh, I've got to get a bunch of graphics cards," and there was a huge run, I'm sure, on the chips the hardware to actually start to mine this.
Yeah, it's had a big impact on the graphics card market. I think for graphics card are kind of uniquely suited to doing a lot of the calculations to do mining, essentially. So they were utilized as a way to kind of to mine, if quote unquote, I mean, I don't know, efficiently, but more efficiently than other types of kind
it's of just a regular
computing
processor, you know, or something like that. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Now, and I think I might have read an article too that the cost of electricity to, because it's sort of a digital arms race, or I guess hardware arms race, to be able to solve these mathematical equations to efficiently data mine, that it doesn't make sense anymore. Have you heard that?
Yeah. So like I said,
Are these the cost of electricity in the US versus say other countries?
Right. So essentially the way that the, I would say, I guess it's software, how it was originally designed was it was designed to kind of create a certain number of Bitcoins every, I don't know, hour or something like that. No matter how many kind of machines there are trying to mine the coins. Mm-hmm. And so that means as more and more machines and more kind of powerful, like, you know, it's not just number of machines, but it's essentially the power and call it like the hashing of, I think the ability to crunch the numbers increases. The same number of coins are being created every moment. So as you imagine, if, you know, the number of people are kind of doing this, then the amount of money you're going to get every hour is going to be in half or something like that. So as it's become more and more popular, the rate at which the return, like the ROI, has gotten lower. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for a while, I think there was a lot of miners in China because they had, made for many reasons, but access to relatively like reasonably priced hardware, but also really, really cheap electricity. I think a lot of mining farms were built on, you know, big rivers where they could get, you know, hydro power very, very, very cheap. Mm-hmm. And then I think China kind of like banned Bitcoin or banned mining and dumped a bunch of graphics cards on the market and stuff like that. And that's recently the prices have come down, but anyway, yeah, energy cost is definitely a big cost of mining this. I mean, it's, you know, that's the variable, that's the kind of the ongoing cost. Some of the cryptocurrencies like Ethereum, they're moving to a new method of validating transactions and validating ownership that doesn't require as much mining power. I don't really know how, I don't remember on top of my head how it works. It's called proof of stake rather than proof of work. And it's supposed to, like, by orders of magnitude, decrease the amount of kind of energy required to maintain the system and stuff like that. So I think that's supposed to be happening later this year, but I'm sure other cryptocurrencies are
trying to solve
something similar, or, you know, something like that, because certainly the cost is expensive, and it's, you know, it's not good for the environment, you know, like,
we're,
you know, the number of transactions Bitcoin supports per second is very, very small compared to like a credit card, like Visa or something like that. And it's already contributing like, you know, single digit percentage to the global kind of energy usage or something like that. So I think to be able to actually be a currency that can support and scale to, you know, serve the intended usage of millions of people using it every day, I think they need to find a solution to do that.
Yeah. And it's fascinating too. Like you're saying, every so often there's going to be more and more introduced, more and more supply introduced into the marketplace. And so in theory, that would potentially, depending on the amount coming in, would decrease the value of what is already owned. But you could say the same thing about the Fed printing money. and you know, controlling the supply of money. So
I think the only difference is, like, for Bitcoin, it's the rate is sort of fixed. It's predictable and known. Uh-huh. And there also is a hard cap at, I think, like 21 million or so is a total number of Bitcoin that it can ever be mined. I don't recall exactly when that's going to happen. Maybe in the next
But it is known.
And few so decades.
People could price it in.
Right, right. And so it's not up to any, you know, central authority to decide when to make more and when to not. It's pretty much destined and predetermined.
Yeah. And yet you have these wild, very, very wild price fluctuations. I think it's safe to say that Bitcoin has, like you mentioned out the gate, the lion's share of the market cap. But what I find fascinating is, like you say, there's a known amount or a total supply that's going to be out there in the world. But really, what we're always consistently comparing it to is another currency, like the US dollar. And so, you know, that's just, again, it's, but you also have people who are very interested in what the technology will do for the space. And so I think you had mentioned as well that there are other coins that do things better than Bitcoin, but just because Bitcoin has got such broad adoption just from an investment perspective, I mean, everybody's talking about that. That's we see these just really crazy swings of people who are just in it for the trade and people who actually are long-term believers. What are your thoughts about those wild? I mean, just to get some numbers around it. I mean, right now, as we're talking, looks like it's one Bitcoin is worth roughly $24,000. Mm-hmm. You know, it went all the way up to $64,000, it looks like, and at one point in back in November of 21. I mean, that's much, much lower than where it was. So obviously, depending on when you bought in, that's I guess how do you view this as an investment, or do you view this as a currency, as a technology, or all of the above?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I don't own any right now, so I don't know if I can call it an investment. I don't think of it as an investment. When I think of an investment, I sort of define it as something that I expect a return and has not only an inherent value, but it has an ability to make a return, right? So, but that's a kind of a.
So it could be like gold,
objective,
right?
Right. Yeah, I don't really consider gold an investment because I don't think of it actually as like being able to provide recurring value. You know, it's not like when I buy a share of a company, right? I am buying a percentage of the future profits of that company. That company has people that are actively working to make money for the company, right? Mm-hmm. So it is, that's why I consider it an investment. Now, if I buy a lawnmower and I think I can rent it out to people, I think that's an investment, right? Because I think it has utility and I can get income from it. Buying gold, I don't know how to rent out gold. I just have to wait on it and then hopefully it's worth more in the future, right? So I think of it as, I don't know if I can call it an investment per se. I think it could have a place in a, I guess it's kind of, yeah, I think it could have a place in an investment portfolio, but it's not really an investment in my mind. But I think of it as something that could have, a large, you know, just increase in value, right? And so it's one of these things where it's more just.
And is that based on speculation? Purely speculation, then?
Yeah, but I think there's a couple of things that I think that do lead me to believe that it's like more valuable than gold, for instance. So one is we were talking about the price of the Bitcoin, which I don't think is that useful, but I think we talk about the market capitalization. So like how much money in Bitcoin is there? So you mentioned, I don't remember exactly, yeah, the price of Bitcoin, 24,000. I don't know what the circulating supply is, about 19 million right now. So, you know, approaching 21 million, but the total market cap, that means like the total value of the Bitcoin outstanding right now or in circulation is 461 billion, right? And then if you compare US dollars, yeah, thank you.
Wow.
But if we compare that to the amount of US dollars in circulation, there's about $2.1 trillion. So that's...
Could you just say those two again? So the it was $461 billion, was it?
Yeah, $461 billion is that right? Actually, closer than I thought, than $2 trillion US dollars. Is that right?
Huh. Okay.
So it's actually like a quarter. It's actually a lot closer than I had thought. The US dollars is, I guess other countries can own US dollars, but it's primarily designed to support the US economy, right? And the US economy is obviously the largest economy in the world. Well, I shouldn't say obviously, pretty sure it is. Bitcoin is a global currency. So if we think of the opportunity for some sort of global currency, like what would be the market share or the market cap of a global currency, presumably would be much, much more than $2 trillion, even though I understand US dollars is sort of oftentimes maybe the quoted price, but I don't know if that's necessarily certainly people in most countries are not, transacting in US dollars every day. They're transacting in their local currency. So I think that's sort of one way to look at it, right? Is like, if this currency is going to become the global currency or the native currency of the internet or even used around the world, like the amount of money in circulation, like value of the market has to be greater to support all these transactions, all these people wanting to use it. And we know that the supply of it is not fixed, but it's incrementing very little bit every few years. And we know the total amount is 21 million. So I think if you believe that the currency will become a popular currency in the future, I think by definition, the value of each Bitcoin has to go up to support the activity, essentially. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was just thinking too, if the value of one Bitcoin was $64,000, which is basically, maybe less than three times as much as it's worth right now, and you said it was like 450 or something like that billion, and there's only like $2 trillion in circulation at the moment. But you look at financial products, I don't have this figure off the top of my head, but I would imagine like just overall balance sheets and debt and everything like that, they might even be higher than that value of the just dollars that are circulating around. But, you get a lot closer to the $2 trillion if you value one Bitcoin at 60 some odd thousand dollars. So
it gets
closer to that 1.2 or whatever to the two, obviously not. It's fascinating how folks are so... I wish I had more data around this, but I think the whole point of this is it's not transparent in terms of we can't tell who owns it from a speculative purpose, who owns it for I believe in it, and maybe there's other reasons why people own it. And the reason I get at it from those angles is like, well, again, what's so interesting about Bitcoin if you have other coins that are developed regularly that have the potential to revolutionize, and that might be the new global standard rather than the US dollar. If you believe in cryptocurrency, does it make sense? I guess what I'm trying to get at is, does it make sense to own just Bitcoin, or does it make sense to own like a bunch of different coins? What are your thoughts there?
That's a great question. I think what you mentioned about, I think I agree with this. I don't think, well, it's been a little while since I've transacted with Bitcoin, but when I did several years ago, it wasn't difficult necessarily. It was not cheap to move money. Like, sending money from one place to another,
like a transaction Bitcoin
cost? Yeah, it costs those transactions. So again, all the computers that are storing this ledger, they have to be compensated for all this energy and this cost. In addition to the mining, they also basically get a transaction fee for processing transactions, essentially.
Oh, wow.
So at the time, sending money was not that cheap. It cost me, it was a few percent or something, I think, to move money from one wallet to another wallet. And it wasn't instant either. It took maybe, I don't remember, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, or an hour or two. So it wasn't like as fast as like sending, you know, paying for something on a credit card. And obviously if I'm paying my credit card as a customer, I'm not paying any fees, but you know, obviously it's maybe built in, I guess, or the seller pays.
And I wonder if you get more and more computers on the system, does it drive the cost down? Or that's just kind of built into the way the coin works?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, definitely the way that the price is, it is, you know, something like based on kind of supply and demand. It's like how many people are trying to, you know, submit a transaction. And there's kind of a fixed capacity of transactions.
Like a bandwidth.
There's a max amount of bandwidth that can be supported at any given time, I think. And it's like, it's almost like an auction. I think you can kind of choose how much money you're willing to spend to make this transaction be processed, or you can pay more to have it processed sooner rather. But if you're not very, you're not in a rush, you can kind of offer a lower price or something like that. And it might take longer to confirm and process. So anyway, it's not a particularly great at moving money right now for low cost, but I think it is the most popular. It has the most kind of support and traction, and it also has a lot of active development community that works on making improvements to it. And like I said, like there's not a single authority that
can unilaterally
make these changes. Yeah. But what can happen is if enough of the computers that are the nodes that are actively kind of supporting the network, if they all agree with certain changes that are proposed, they can kind of like vote by adopting a new version of the software or something like that. And that's what they call forking, where like there's been forks of things where, you know, there may be disagreements on how to go forward, and some people will kind of propose this new thing. They'll release this new software and it gets voted on essentially, or it gets forked because all the network, they kind of decide which side to take, and that becomes, and you can have different forks of currencies that way. And I'm kind of probably oversimplifying and missing some things, but there are ways to make improvements to it. You have to convince the community of people that are mining and you know, operating these nodes that it is better, and somehow it's better for them as well. So I think there is definitely an opportunity for the technology to get better and, you know, more reliable and cheaper and faster for moving money.
Yeah, and if there's anything that's you know, constantly true is you know, when there's a lot of money involved, there will be a lot of eyes and attention put towards it, and maybe that's helpful to keep the staying power of Bitcoin propelled forward into the future. So going back to my question, do you think it makes sense to own, like, let's say that, again, the average person out there is like, yeah, I do want to own Bitcoin. Maybe they already have Bitcoin. Like, or they do want to get into crypto. And a lot of times people, like myself included, like crypto equals Bitcoin. And, you know, there's others out there. Like, how should you go about this if you say yes? If you go down the process, you can say yes, I want to buy crypto.
Yeah. So that's a good question. So I think, like you asked about all these different cryptocurrencies, there are so many out there. You could spend, you know, your whole life discovering a new one probably every hour for your rest of your life, and you probably won't even, you know,
and practically you can't always move dollars to these new things. You sometimes have to have a stable coin to use to invest in these. It's not as easy as just, you know, go to your currency exchange and
depends. Yeah. So like in the US, you know, we have Coinbase. They're like one of the largest exchanges, I guess we'd say, in the US as well as globally. And they actually offer, I don't know, probably hundreds of coins now where you can just take US dollars, convert them into these coins. And so for most people in the US, I think you can probably buy exactly what you want. Any of the most kind of common ones. But yeah, if you're really looking to get into these really like new or esoteric ones, you might need to, you know, buy something and then trade it for somewhere else. The thing is there's so many, right? So I think it is challenging to decide what you would kind of, you know, what you would want to choose to kind of quote unquote invest in or to buy. I think there is a good reason just to stick to the, you know, Bitcoin, or maybe the Bitcoin, Ethereum. Ethereum's like far and away like the second sort of largest in terms of market cap and all that stuff. You know, I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot of people that have done research, but I do think there's a lot of correlation in the market. You know, back in 2017, I actually had purchased many. I was like really interested, and I read a bunch of white papers. I ended up buying like 10 or 15 different coins, and some did really well. Or actually, I bought like maybe 5 or 6. Some did really well. I sold them. I wanted to quote unquote diversify and bought others. And then end of 2017, the kind of market tanked and they all tanked. Like, and so I think there's a lot of correlation in between them. I mean, certainly a lot of them will maybe like pop or do really well, like especially, you know, it depends on what some circumstances. So I think there could be some value in diversification, but it's just how much time do you want to spend, right? So it just really depends on how much time do you want to spend researching and how much time do you want to be thinking about this, right? And so I think this is kind of leading to our next topic is like, we talk about this a bit and maybe in earlier episodes about how do you create a plan and how do you stick to that plan? I think your plan is only as good as if you can actually stick to it, especially at something in crypto, because it's so volatile. Like, you know, if you think investing in the stock market is volatile and you're worried about, you know, a 30% decline, like you better hold on for way more than that in crypto. It could be twice, three times that. And so I think you really need to, I think just like anything else, you need to have a plan, hold on to it, not sell based on what the market is doing. I still think. And so I think whatever you need to do that, I think is the right thing to do. So I don't currently own any still, but I've been talking to you and like kind of thinking about buying some Bitcoin. Not because I think it's the best, but because I think it will kind of approximate the cryptocurrency market. And I think in just having one, I think is makes it simpler. And I think I value that and not having to waste time or thinking about, oh, should I buy the second one, the third one, should I rebalance between them? So just trying to simplify things, I think is would really help. But anyway, again, if you're in the US, you can just go to Coinbase and you can buy it there. But there's many kind of pros and cons as to like, where do you keep your coins after you buy them? I think that's something that people should be aware of, some of the choices that you have there, because there are some, each one kind of has its own risks, really, to be honest with you. So, you know, if you go to Coinbase, and you just buy your coins there and you keep them there, there's a few risks there, right? One is you could have your account hacked, right? Like you might accidentally give out your password to, you could be phished, right? You could actually give out your password to someone and they could steal your coin. Basically, they could just log into your account, send the coin to another account. And I don't think Coinbase is really going to help you there because they've lost the funds. And what is the unique values of cryptocurrency is that it cannot be reversed. It's not like, oh, someone made a purchase on your credit card and you just, you know, fill out a form, say you didn't do it, you get your money back. Typically doesn't happen in cryptocurrency because the money is gone. It can't be reversed. And so that's a risk of keeping those funds on an exchange. The other possibility is that maybe you don't have your account compromised, but maybe Coinbase itself gets hacked, right? Maybe a rogue employee does something, steals a bunch of money, or maybe they get phished or something like that. Or maybe Coinbase goes insolvent or something with that. You know, there's many things that, or they could just mess things up. They could, I don't know, delete the wrong thing and whatever, lose your keys. Basically, you don't own the keys, right? Because basically, when Coinbase has it, you know, they have the cryptographic keys to your wallet. If you even have your own wallet, I'm not really sure. You might just be kind of part of a big wallet, essentially, and they get your access to it. And so, or, you know, another risk too is Coinbase could decide, you know what, you broke their terms of service, maybe, and maybe they're not going to give you access. That's kind of extreme, but certainly that's a possibility, I think. So that's sort of a risk of keeping your money on a exchange, really. Another option, which I mentioned earlier, which is maybe for the people who want to kind of control their own destiny, they can keep their funds in their own wallet. That means they have their own keys to it. And again, as long as you don't lose those keys or you don't have those keys stolen, you have full control of it. And so but there's risks, right? Because you could lose those keys. The key, it's just like a long, long password. Imagine like a really long password. You know, if you lose it and can't find it, or someone steals it from you, they could take all your money. And again, there's no way to kind of get back. So that's sort of a risk. And then the other options we talked about earlier, or we talked about previously, was you can buy like an ETF actually of crypto now, right? There's ETFs that offer crypto, and you can buy that maybe even in a brokerage or potentially in a Roth IRA. Those things tend to have pretty large fees though as well. Sometimes they have kind of annual expense ratios of what, somewhere between like 1 to 2 to 3% or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we talk a lot about, well, we try to talk about low cost index fund as the best way to invest. And unfortunately, the ETFs are not low cost. They're pretty high cost in terms of expense ratios. You know, maybe that's okay. Like you're sort of, at the end of the day, you're not expecting like a very consistent return every year with this. You're kind of, you're almost kind of buying like a lottery ticket, to be honest with you. I think with this, like I kind of think of it as, again, not an investment, but as a small sort of insurance against, you know, regretting that you didn't buy anything because you just sat on the sideline, sort of thing. So anyway, that's one option as well. And I think for the most part, we looked at those, and maybe there's more research required, but it seems like a lot of them are, they own contracts, like future contracts. So they don't actually own the Bitcoin themselves, for instance, or the cryptocurrency themselves. So I think there's a less of a risk of what I was talking about in terms of getting hacked or getting, you know, something like that. So those are kind of like three different ways that you can get kind of own Bitcoin. Probably the most popular way is, yeah, ETF, keeping it on an exchange, or keeping the keys yourself in your own wallet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that's awesome to go through all of those different ways of getting exposure and owning Bitcoin, but any other type of crypto for that matter. I think I remember seeing some ETFs, your last point, some ETFs do own it, and, you know, others that, yeah, maybe they just have exposure to, yeah, like futures contracts where they're just, it's kind of based on what the value, the future value of those, end up doing. So, and to my knowledge, there is no like the Fidelity or the Schwab or the Vanguard crypto index fund. I wouldn't be surprised if they do come out with that at some point, but some of these early adopters too in the ETF landscape, if you look under the hood, some of them are just purely owning Bitcoin. Some of them are or pseudo owning Bitcoin, and then some of them own a handful of others. But when you look at just the market cap, if you were to take our advocated approach to investing, where you're just buying indices, and it's that indice is based on the overall market cap or the total value of each underlying crypto in this case versus a company. Bitcoin, again, far and away, I was looking at one that it only tracks 10 crypto currencies, and like, for example, Bitcoin made up like 67% or 70% of the overall index, and then Ethereum was like the next biggest one when that was like 24%, and you only had like a handful. The other eight were just very, very small percentages, and that was just simply a function of so I think the benefit of owning the ETF is those, in theory, will adjust over time to without you having to buy or sell yourself and maybe get left behind. But they don't, you know, they're not doing this out of the kindness of their heart, and I think this particular fund is charging 2% ongoing fee to manage this, 2.5%, I'm sorry, even higher, which is just nuts when you compare it to like VTSAX or any other index fund where you're talking about south of 0.1% expense ratio.
Yeah, they're definitely high-ish fees when we think about them compared to ETFs or low-cost index funds. But buying the coins yourself on Coinbase, that's not fee free either. It's been a little while since I've done that, but I think it really depends on kind of the volume that you're buying. And again, they have like a consumer facing kind of website. They also have a more kind of professional trader version of the website. And previously you could just kind of, if you knew the right URL, you can, and you know how to navigate through UI and kind of, make a trade there. I think it would go as low as 1% we looked at, but it was still like 1% for buying. If you're selling again later or rebalancing, that's another 1%. So that's 2%. So that's obviously not 2% per year.
Right.
But that's, it all depends on how long you hold it for. And that was, I think, the professional site or the trader's website, the consumer site. I mean, if you buy $100 of Bitcoin on Coinbase, like first of all, they may not be transparent as it's a fee. They might be kind of, just not giving you a great exchange price or something, but it's closer to 5% or something like that. So it can be significant there as well. And then, storing it on a hardware wallet, you still have to buy it somewhere. So that's just an extra step that you're taking. Like if you wanted to store the funds on a hardware wallet, you can't buy your like Bitcoin through a hardware wallet. You still have to buy it on an exchange somewhere like Coinbase, but there are other options as well. Probably are, lower cost options out there, but then you just have to buy it. And then instead of keeping it on the exchange, you send it. So you put in the address of your wallet and you send it. And that usually the sending is going to cost the fee as well. So there's definitely a lot of fees all around. And I think over time, like my hope and my, I think for these currencies to become used as currencies and not just a kind of speculative store value, like the fees have to come down. Like they have to figure out more efficient ways of maintaining the handling the volume of transactions in a secure manner, because otherwise I think it is can be prohibitive as to their goals of the projects.
Yeah. Well, and then again, just going back to the dollars and the US dollar value of the total amount in Bitcoin, I mean, that's quite a lot of money. And again, I would think that again, over time, like you're saying, that there would be competition and perhaps drive down the cost. I think Coinbase is at such a size where there's not really too many other, I could be misspeaking here, but too many big competitors that could, they almost are like kind of like a monopoly in that space. But hopefully over time the friction, the fee friction is reduced to a point where you've got easier access to it. And I think it's helped out as it's become more mainstream. I know we were talking in preparation for this conversation about Fidelity, I think it was allowing 401k participants to invest in crypto. And I don't know exactly what funds that they allow, I think it was perhaps just an early glimpse into what their plans are or what exactly that looks like. I haven't stumbled across a 401k that has that available, because oftentimes companies are like slower to move and in terms of offering and these different investment options, these newer ones that come across their desks. But that is fascinating to me, that it just kind of starts to again solidify that crypto is not just some flash in the pan thing.
I'm pretty confident that if and when Fidelity actually offers the ability to buy Bitcoin in your 401k, if I'm not the first one to be able to do that, I don't know which is, because my company is very a big advocate of Bitcoin and spends a non-trivial amount of resources developing Bitcoin products and contributes to the Bitcoin project. So we do use Fidelity as well. So I'm curious to see that. I mean, I think it's good for people to have options. I think it is obviously could be potentially dangerous. I think we don't want, I wouldn't recommend anybody like put their entire 401k contributions into Bitcoin. But I think it's kind of related that, like, if you, what would you recommend for people who are interested in Bitcoin? Like, how do they, I think one of the challenges for me as well, I guess just like how do they think about Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency as part of their asset allocation? And then, how do they go about maybe thinking about rebalancing or something like that, or just maintaining that desired allocation.
Yeah, well, I just go back to the textbook definition from a certified financial planner perspective, which is limit your exposure to any one company or investment to no more than 5% of your overall net worth. I think that's a good kind of rule of thumb, and I think that gives you certainly enough exposure to if you know, you buy in at 24,000 and this thing goes up to 64 or even higher, 100,000, that you're still getting that upside without necessarily risking the betting the farm on that. So I'd say generally speaking, that's kind of my rough recommendation. You have anything, any other additional comment? Happy to talk on how to rebalance and stuff like that, but
yeah,
it's kind of straightforward from my perspective, like that way you're not ruining your,
I think that makes sense. I think the only issue, well, not issue, but challenge I can mention, right now, because you can't buy Bitcoin really in your 401k. I mean, you can buy these ETFs now. My 401k doesn't offer these ETFs. I think, if you were to buy Bitcoin on Coinbase, right? Essentially, the way that the IRS treats cryptocurrencies is they treat it as that's just like an asset,
right? Investment.
So essentially, when you go to sell it, that's a taxable event, right? Mm-hmm. So the act of rebalancing across your quote unquote portfolio, if you bought it in just a Coinbase account, is a taxable event. And so maybe not the end of the world, if you hold that investment for more than a year, you're paying long-term capital gains, which could be 0 or 20%, I think, right? Depending on your
tax bracket. Yeah, 0, 15, 20, and potentially up to 23.8%.
Oh, okay. Federal.
Yeah.
So you could incur taxes there, which is a bit unfortunate. And obviously that would be the case too if you were to buy any type of stock in a brokerage account. But I think the reason why it's unfortunate, you can't right now just buy Bitcoin in a tax sheltered account. However, I think I guess I haven't checked, but I believe a lot of Roth IRAs probably offer access to some of these ETFs. So that is one advantage of buying one of these ETFs, even though they have a high expense ratio. The ease of rebalancing without incurring kind of taxable events is potentially a benefit.
And I think what you're referring to is the asset location where you're putting potentially tax inefficient assets. Now, there isn't any sort of income component to it other than there's no like dividends or something like that, to my understanding. Maybe there's a coins out there that provide that, but
yeah,
there's some
that are kind of very, yeah, they're kind of, that's what they do primarily. And I don't really know much about them to speak to them. Yeah.
Hmm. But yeah, if we're talking about Bitcoin, that clearly has been a very high, very volatile, and very high growth oriented investment. So, where do you put those assets traditionally? And a great place to put them could be your Roth IRA, because those gains, like you say, are not taxed. And so, when you pull the money out, if you're 59.5, you're not subjected to the 10% penalty and certain limited circumstances too. You can withdraw your contributions, but you can, limited circumstances, you withdraw your earnings. So it's just a really nice vehicle to put high growth assets, because that's the most, from a traditional withdrawdown strategy, you would do potentially some mix of all three buckets of taxable, tax deferred, and tax free. But in a perfect world, I think leaving the tax free to grow as long as possible in a traditional retirement case makes a lot of sense. So maybe we chat about like rebalancing in general, and obviously in the Roth, and you wouldn't necessarily have to worry about the tax component of it, but if you don't have access to investing in some of these ETFs that provide exposure to the crypto, or for one reason or another you're not able to get there, you could just use it in your regular Coinbase account. And again, this kind of is on the heels of our rebalancing conversation, where we talk about when to buy and sell. And so again, the notion here is that we're always selling things that are doing well and buying things that are not doing so well. I mean, there's a reason that you're invested in the first place, and you've got conviction that over the long run, each one of these different components is going to do better than cash, really. So I guess the way I would go about trying to rebalance this, if you didn't have the benefit of software, say from like a personal capital or some other type of software that shows you just kind of how you are, you know, what your asset allocation is across all these different accounts, is just to create a spreadsheet and have the same discipline that you have in that account that you would in any other investment account. I'd say far and away, the amount of clients that I have who just maybe they've got, you know, a small percentage, but, you know, maybe we'll just call it $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 in various types of crypto, and they don't rebalance it. They just sort of say, you know what, hey, this will do what it does, and hopefully in the future it will, you know, turn out okay, and maybe it'll be the home run. But I think a more disciplined approach is, especially with something so volatile, you know, when Bitcoin goes up to $64,000, you know, and that as a percentage is higher than, let's say, it's your 5% cut off there, and that's the amount. Maybe it's now turned into 7. Well, you sell that down. That's the whole idea of this. And then you go and take that 2% and you go and reinvest it in the place where you're less the right allocation there. So under allocated. So that's sort of kind of my rough thoughts there. And you could go as far as creating an investment policy statement too, which is a statement, is a fancy combination of words saying it's saying what do you believe about this investment? What would mandate a trade, mm-hmm. a rebalancing trade? Like, what is the percentage that you want to have in relation to your overall? Like I said, that's that 5%. Maybe you've got some tolerance thresholds where you're saying, okay, maybe if it drifts up 20% of 5%, what is that math real quick? So 0.1, so 5.1%, it could be the thing, or it drifts lower than, and that's the other part of this too. If you're saying it's 5% and it drifts down below to 1%, then
you gotta buy more.
Yeah, that's also what you're saying. Which is risky, to say the least.
Yeah, I feel like the approach for rebalancing shouldn't differ greatly. It's just that the challenges is the volatility of it. And I think mm-hmm. that can make it more difficult for people to rebalance in both situations, right?
If it's then doing it buys really well, more frequent, like, rebalancing.
Right. So I think you have to kind of pay attention to it more. So yeah, I think that's
really unless you're bound by, instead of it being tolerance bands, maybe you're just bound by, hey, I'm going to look at this quarterly, semi-annually, or annually, and it's just on a calendar basis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then again, like the tax rate for me, I'm always like, I probably over
concentrate on the tax.
Over concentrate on tax minimization. So I'd be like, oh, I don't want to like rebalance this and pay tax capital gains and stuff. But you know, again, if that's what you've decided to do, and then you should obviously do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of white papers out there that really stress the benefits of rebalancing in relation to the tax drag, and that outweighs the downside of you know, paying a little bit in taxes. But in the same respect, you know, if you bought in at $61,000 or $64,000 and it's now down to $24,000 or whatever that fraction is, and you know, maybe more, you know, lesser sums of money, you have a tax loss harvesting that you can do just like you can with any other investment. And so you can, you know, kind of use that. And I mean, the way I guess I would approach that in this world would be, okay, maybe you're not holding Bitcoin, maybe you got Ethereum, and then you just go back in the wash sale rule of 30 days before the day of the transaction, 30 days after. Basically, if you didn't tune in to the rebalancing and tax loss harvesting episode, highly recommend it. It's a good one. But if you were to sell an investment at a loss and you immediately go and buy back in, the IRS disallows that loss and they just carry over that that cost basis or what you bought in at or that loss into the new investment. So they're not able to realize that loss. So that's why you would go into a neighboring investment type. Now, again, the merits of Bitcoin versus Ethereum, that could be debated, but those are different. So that would achieve the goal from a wash sale prevention perspective. Mm-hmm. So cool. Is there anything else? I mean, we talked about a lot this episode. Anything else that you want to share broadly about crypto? I'm sure there's more to say, and perhaps that'll be a future episode as well. But
yeah, I think just create a plan before kind of diving in, or if you already have crypto, like work on a plan and like think hard about a plan and really do your best to stick with it. I think that is going to, you know, set you up for success and let you, you know, sleep well at night and not hopefully worry a little bit less about the day to day market swings. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even if you are so jumping on the bandwagon, so to speak, and maybe don't have, because to be fair, this is complex. There's a lot of things going on with this technology and how it works. And, you know, will it be the future? I don't know. You know, will it be Bitcoin? Will it be something? I don't know. But yeah, just the simple thesis of investing is making sure you know what you're investing in and have conviction in that. And so if that passes that test, then it should belong in your overall asset allocation, then, you know, don't invest more than 5% into that one particular allocation and be ready to do some rebalancing because it is a volatile asset class at the moment. So, you know, your overall investment portfolio, you know, shouldn't be changing every single day or week or month or quarter, or maybe even it takes a handful of years before you kind of come back to the table and say, hey, I don't know if Bitcoin needs to be in this. Maybe we need to add a little bit more. Maybe you add some more Ethereum. I know in this space, again, things are moving so quickly. So maybe as part of that investment policy statement, you're adding other elements to, you know, hey, like what one item could be like, oh, see what the market cap is of Bitcoin in relation to the other coins and do that on a quarterly basis or a semi-annual basis or something like that, would it, you know, warrant whether to include or exclude the crypto. So yeah, there's a lot here, but I don't think it's anything that's overly complex if people spend some time and just kind of read up on it and some of the basics. So well, very good. Well, thank you all for your time and listening. I'm curious if you all have specific experiences or stories around crypto and maybe Bitcoin and its ups and downs. And at the moment, I think that what they call it's a crypto winter. We're in the crypto winter time frame. So even though it's the middle of summer now, maybe it's in Australia they're looking talking about. But yeah, let us know. Feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. That's feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. And you know, who knows? We'll probably in the future do a Q&A mailbox episode of your stories and so forth. But that's it for us. Tune in next time to another hopefully interesting conversation and where you're learning more about personal finance and just getting better every day, learning a little bit more. So thank you, everybody. Hope you have a good rest of your day. Take care.
We're a new podcast, and it would mean the world to us if you took a moment to write a review in the Apple Podcasts app or share this episode with a friend or family member. We'd like to hear from you. Is there a topic you're interested in? Have feedback more generally? Email us at feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. Thanks, and see you next time.